weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Well, a big thanks to Beda da Silva for driving us through the afternoon. It is Wednesday, August 28. I'm Shane Dawson and you are listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7pm, Paul Corry is with us to keep an eye on St. Pat's Conference League playoff in Turkey, where it is currently 0-0 at half-time. So far, so good for Pats. We'll also be rounding up all of the latest transfer news and look ahead to Rovers in Greece. Siobhan Madigan dials in from Paris ahead of the Paralympic Games opening ceremony this evening. In tennis, Stephen Higgins brings us up to date on the US Open, while Michael Corcoran tells us what next for Felix Jones. As always, if you want to get in touch, you can send us a message on 51552, WhatsApp 0871879200, or we are on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Good evening. Welcome along to the show. Before we get into all of that, great news for Eddie Dunbar, who has just claimed the first Grand Tour stage win of his career following a perfectly timed sprint at the end of stage 11 of La Vuelta. The 27-year-old from Cork was part of a large breakaway that held their advantage at the end of the hilly 166.5-kilometre stage that started and finished in Padrón. Dunbar sprung from the group in the final kilometre, taking stronger sprinters by surprise to claim a phenomenal victory and now moves up to 18th in the general classification. So absolutely outstanding news for Eddie Dunbar on a day that Technology University of the Shannon and Cycling Ireland have signed a memorandum of understanding to develop a new velodrome in Limerick City. So great news for cycling. I was going to say great news for Pats, but they're drawing at the moment, Paul. It's good news for Pats. So far, so good, fair to say.
Yeah, absolutely. So far, so good. Really good first half from Stephen Kenny's side. I mean, going into this game and looking at the 90 minutes as a whole, Shane, given the first leg result, it was so important that it didn't concede early, and they've done really well in the first 45 minutes to keep a clean sheet. They actually worked one or two really good opportunities. The best one of them fell to Keane Levy. He broke free of the Turkish defence. He got himself into a good position, probably from a wide angle, and he's dragged a shot across the goal, and that was probably as good as it came for Pats. There has been one or two hairy moments. I mean, Sjoberg has cleared one off the line, and there's been a couple of instances where the ball was like ping-ponging around the box and a deflection here or there, and Pats maybe could have been in trouble. But I mean, by and large, they've restricted the Turkish side. I keep saying Turkish side because I want to pronounce Bazak Kasir.
It's actually here.
They've restricted
Istanbul, Paul.
Istanbul. Yeah, they've restricted them pretty well. I mean, what is important now in the second half, Shane, is that they don't sit too deep and they don't invite a huge amount of pressure, and they don't end up in a situation where they're camped on the edge of the 18-yard box. Mason Melia becomes really isolated top end of the pitch, and they just can't get out. So important that you do as best as you can to retain possession of the ball, hold the ball up with Mason Melia, try to get bodies around him and use the pace that they have in the final third. Mulroney and Elbazetti can be really threatening from wide areas. Melia can spin and run in behind. Can they get those three players in particular into the game? And you've also got the legs then from Levy behind to support. So it's been a fantastic first half, Shane, to still be in this tie against a team with a budget and resources far and away, you know, 10, 100x what St. Pat's have is a fantastic achievement. But it's now, what can they do over the next 45, if it goes into extra time, to actually get out of this tie and get into the group stages? Probably need to take one of a few chances that they might create. Maybe might create something from a set piece, or like we saw in the last round, maybe, you know, there's a sending off that changes the tide of this game. But what we've seen from them the first 45 minutes is really well set up, really disciplined, restricted the number of chances that they've had to defend against. That's going to become tougher as the game goes on. But what they've done so far, they've done very well.
I don't want to put the mockers on them, but I'd imagine the message from Stephen Kenny is do not concede in the third quarter, at least the first 10 minutes of the second half. Just stay solid, just stay compact. And then, as you mentioned, all of those counter-attacking options that perhaps can get at Istanbul.
That's it. I mean, the worry is that, you know, Bazkasir get one and then they get two. And then, you know, the energy is really drained from Pats. You know, the climate and the conditions that they have to play in is very difficult. So keep it nil all for as long as you possibly can and hope that you can nick something on the counter-attack. They've got good options on the bench, Shane. You know, the likes of Keane, who they've brought in, Jay McCallum can come in there and keep the ball for you. Bulger, Brandon Kavanagh, they've good players who are comfortable with the ball at their feet, but to your point, it's keep it 0-0 for as long as you possibly can, hope that you can nick something.
Yeah. Just final one, Paul, you will be keeping an eye on the second half, as we're going to go across to Siobhan in Paris now very shortly, but just Turkish crowds are usually hostile. Just from looking at the pictures, it's a bit of a sparse crowd for, and like, this isn't Galatasaray or Fenerbahce. Like, Istanbul are notoriously, they don't have that perhaps hardcore following and devout following that other clubs might have. So that is one thing that perhaps Pats don't have to contend with as much.
Yeah, it's certainly an element that they're not having to contend with. I think when we hear of Turkish opposition, we think of Sunes.
Yeah,
putting the flag in the middle of the pitch. This is not that sort of
welcome to hell. Yeah,
no, it's absolutely not. And you can actually see in the first 30 seconds of the second half, like, Pats have had instances where they've actually been able to spray the ball about, and they seem comfortable in that environment. It's certainly not Fenerbahce. It's not Galatasaray. This is an environment where you can probably put your shoulders back and express yourself when you get possession of the ball. So that's certainly one less thing to contend with. But there are players there, Shane, who have, you know, extensive experience, like to Forrester and Lennon, even Jake Mulroney, and the level he would have played in the MLS and those sort of situations. So certainly got the capabilities to contend with it. It's just whether or not we can get them over the line.
If you can do it running down the wing in Tala Stadium or Daly Mountain Talkie, you can take a bit of abuse in Istanbul, no bother to them. Well, here's hoping for a big second half from St. Pat's. The second half has just kicked off. What's on the clock? 46 minutes and 20 seconds. So, Paul, you will be keeping an eye on that. From a hostile environment to a much more welcoming one, Siobhan Madigan is in Paris for the Paralympic Games. Not long since the Olympic Games came to a close, the Paralympic Games opening ceremony is this evening. What is the environment and atmosphere like over in Paris at the moment, Siobhan?
Yeah, hi Shane. I suppose we had great success for the Olympic Games. It was a wonderful success for the city of Paris, and now we're ready to almost do it all again. The second half, I suppose, of what's been a magical Parisian summer, and it gets underway, what, within the next 2 hours. Local organisers have promised once again a Paralympic Games, what they say, will be one to remember and one to rival London 2012. Proceedings due to get underway at 7 o'clock Irish time. And just like the opening ceremony for the Olympics, tonight's proceedings will again be open and in the heart of Paris City, in front of thousands of spectators, free of charge to the public. And it'll all centre at the bottom of the Champs-Élysées, around the largest and most beautiful of squares in Paris, the Place de la Concorde. A record of 165 countries are set to take part in the Games, over 22 sports. It ranges for 11 days. Ireland have 35 strong teams that compete across 9 sports, and there's really an awful lot to look forward to. And the Irish team say they hope to match or succeed our Tokyo medal tally of 7. So confidence is good, the feeling is good, and we're all looking forward to it just getting underway now at this stage.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I do want to pick your brain on perhaps some of the competitors that we might see medal for Team Ireland. But just on Paris itself, like, I was reading it, it's invested over 125 million to make the city more accessible, and that investment is part of the game's legacy in Paris. And like, ticket sales from various reports as well, that they're brisk at the moment, so there is genuine buy-in, and it is going to be a great atmosphere that you would imagine most, if not all, of the events, Siobhan.
Ah, absolutely. And you know, like, Parisians, they left the city ahead of the games fearing traffic chaos and disruption and whatnot. And boy, were they wrong, because, you know, worldwide, the Paris Olympics were probably the biggest success that ever could have been imagined by this city. And so with that, as the people have come back to Paris, it's they now who are investing. It's they now who are splashing out for tickets for the Paralympic Games, because they feel that they've almost missed out on something special, and they don't want to give up that second chance to miss out a second time. But, you know, you're talking about with Team Ireland, and as I say, a 35-strong team, but it is somewhat of a less experienced team than we sent to Tokyo 3 years ago for the 2021 Games. The likes of Jason Smith, the multiple Olympic Paralympic gold medal winning sprinter, the likes of Michael McKillop, and the high jumper Jordan Lee, they miss out. Jason and Michael have both moved on. They've retired from Paralympic sport, and Jordan Lee misses out through injury. Our cyclist, Katie George Dunleavy, who of course has had tremendous success along with the Steve McChrystal in the tandem bike races, both on the track and on the road. Well, she's only come back from a pretty significant broken collarbone injury. So, you know, we need to curtail our expectation of her. She took home 2 gold medals and a silver in Tokyo. What can she reproduce? Can she reproduce her best given the nature of that injury? And Orla Comerford, who will be one of the Irish flag bearers this evening, she goes in the S13 100 metre sprint event. Now, a little bit earlier in the summer, she sprinted against Rashida Adeleke in the National Able-Bodied Championship. So we know what Orla Comerford can do, but she too has had her injury concerns over for the last while. And then there's Ellen Keane. This is going to be a swan song games for Ellen. Of course, she was 13 years of age when she made her debut in Beijing way back in 2008. She's the defending Paralympic champion coming here. Can she reproduce it when it matters most? Time ticks by on us all, ages catching up with Ellen, but maybe she can go out in the high that she's hoping for.
Here's hoping, most certainly. Given that the household names, for want of a better phrase, that you mentioned there, and the couple of perhaps injury issues that some may have to contend with, and Ellen Keane, as you say, coming at the other end of her career. So this could be a Paralympic Games that we see some fresh faces and some new names get medals and etch their name into Irish Paralympic folklore.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one swimmer in particular to look out for is Roisin Ní Rian from Limerick. She was 15 years of age when we went to Tokyo 3 years ago. So she's now 18 years of age, but she has that much more experience. She understands the level of competition now at Paralympic level, and she's done it herself at European level and at world championship level. Can she transfer that now onto the next level and deliver the big performance when it's needed here in Paris? And she'll be one of the first into action tomorrow in the pool, and much is expected from the likes of Roisin Ní Rian. You know, our other flag bearer tonight is Colin Judge. Colin, you know, has suffered mentally and physically over the course of time, but he says he's feeling near his best. He's ranked number 10 in the world going into the table tennis event. And of course, you know, that's a real kill-throat event, because it's one hit and you're out. It's straight knockout. But Colin Judge is feeling probably the best, he says, that he's ever felt coming here. So perhaps he's going to be a new one that will come to the fore for Irish Paralympic sport. Like, the options are endless, you know. Like, we've a load of new faces in our cycling team, and we know the success that cycling has produced over the last number of Paralympic cycling competitions. So perhaps, you know, we'll be looking at new names coming to the fore to take over from, as I say, the forementioned Eve McChrystal and Katie George Dunleavy. But I suppose only time will tell, because, you know, it's one thing talking about it, it's another thing actually doing it when the time comes.
The action does come thick and fast. It's 11 days of competitive action, a 12-day tournament or competition, if you will. So you mentioned Roisin Ní Rian is in action tomorrow. So she goes, now these are all Irish times, 10:30 in the heat of the S13 100-metre butterfly. And then a final, if she does qualify, is at 7:10. So it's a short turnaround, similar with Dervla Brady and Nicole Turner also in the pool.
Yeah, but these swimmers are used to operating to these kind of schedules, because, as I say, when they go and compete internationally, these smaller events are tailor-made to replicate when the athlete will get to this kind of an arena. So, yes, it'll be a big morning for Dervla Brady, who'll be appearing at her opening Paralympic Games. Nicole Turner has been here before. She won a medal in Tokyo. She's hoping to upgrade that medal here in Paris. As I say, Roisin Ní Rian is certainly one to look out for. Rochelle Timothy goes in the C1 3000 individual pursuit at the Velodrome, and we also have 4 men going in the 4000 5,000 individual pursuit. Damien Vericker and Mitchell McLaughlin team up, as do Martin Gordon and Owen Mullen. And Kerry Leonard, another of the Irish team members who's appearing at her second Paralympic Games, she takes aim in the ranking round in the W2 individual compound open of the para archery competition. And, you know, Kerry was a real novice going into Tokyo a couple of years ago, and a little bit like Colin Judge in the table tennis, she now knows and expects the performance from herself that's much, much better than what she produced in Tokyo. And, you know, like, it's all about producing that performance when it matters. You can sound like a broken record talking about any sort of elite sports people producing it, but this is the place to do it if you're heading into a Paralympics.
Yeah, we actually played an interview with Kerry Leonard on the show before. She's an absolute breath of fresh air, really great character, and a national champion as well in archery overall in Ireland, and now competing in para archery as well. And it struck me, actually, one of her quotes was kind of just saying that she just wants to come back happy and kind of do her best as well. But there's a weight of expectation on certain athletes as well that they've to contend with representing Team Ireland in these games.
Well, this is it. Like, you know, these Paralympians, they tend not to be to the forefront of sporting coverage other than once maybe every 4 years. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden they become household names. And that in itself brings pressure. And remember, a lot of these athletes that are certainly coming to their second Paralympics won't have experienced anything like what they will over the next number of days, because Tokyo was behind closed doors. It was a soulless games. Paris, as you've seen on your television on your television screens, heard on your radio over the course of the last month, it's absolutely buzzing. And you can bet your bottom dollar, if you're in against any sort of a French team or a French individual in any event, you're up against two people, or they have an extra man on their team, because the French public has just bought into these games like nothing before. And as I referenced a little bit earlier, the Parisians that missed out on the Olympics are not missing out the second time, and it's they who have bought all the tickets.
Yeah. In terms of Irish support, listen, I know we're only at the opening ceremony this evening, and a couple of the coaches and the backroom team of Team Ireland were hinting at the fact that it might be day trips for Irish fans out there. Have you witnessed many Irish fans already out there, or do you think it kind of will build as the competition goes on?
Yeah, we only got here ourselves yesterday. I was surprised we didn't meet any certainly green-cladded supporters in the airport or on the flight, but I have no doubt that they'll come from anywhere and everywhere, just like they did for the Olympics. It'll be planes, trains and automobiles, and whether it's day trips or overnight trips or an 11-day trip, they'll be here.
Brilliant stuff. Siobhan, thanks so much for checking in. The opening ceremony is on this evening, and as I mentioned, we have plenty of Irish athletes in action tomorrow. We've Paris swimming at 10 a.m. Dervil Brady and Nicole Turner are in the pool of the S6 50 metre freestyle heats final in the evening. Then if they do qualify, Roisin Nareen, as mentioned by Siobhan, then para cycling from 12 p.m. onwards, and para archery, Kerry Leonard meets Kerry Leonard at 12 p.m. ranking in the W2 individual compound open. And you can follow all of the action from the Paralympic Games with coverage on rte.ie/sport, the RTE News app, or you can watch live on RTE2 and the RTE Player. And we will have updates and live commentaries across RTE Radio 1. And we'll have a roundup every evening here on Game on 2FM. As I look up at the screen, Paul Corrie, and at one stage I saw the Patrick's goalkeeper down with an injury. It seems to be all Istanbul this half. Am I wrong?
I wouldn't say it's all Istanbul, but I would say that they've probably had by and large a majority of possession. But I think Pats will still be very comfortable, Shane, with the opportunities that they've restricted them to have. There have been one or two openings as well for Pats on the counter-attack. I think, you know, Mulroney, if he's a little better in wide areas, he can do more. And there was also opportunity there where Levy's breaking free. He can just slip a ball down to Mulroney and you may be creating overload in a wide area. So those kind of decisions in the final third need to be really good to open up Baza Kashir. But I mean, Shane, the longer this game goes on excuse me, they're really in this tie. Like, you know, that there's a massive opportunity,
as they have a half break,
massive opportunity for Pats to actually go through in this game. I'm not sure I really believe that heading into the game just the travel and the fact that they were playing Turkish opposition and the levels that maybe you might see a different side than the one that we saw last week. We often see that with Irish sides in Europe when they play teams in their own home turf, they can up at a couple of levels. Pass up really comfortable. Like they don't look as if, you know, they're being peppered on goal. They don't look as if they're not having a little feel of the ball and spells of possession every now and again. They're well in this tie, and it feels like one goal, whichever team gets it, will be enough to go through.
We're going to have to get the heart monitor out for our producer, John, a devout St. Patrick's fan, in the gallery here with us, as Pats do go on in the attack here. And that's, like, as you mentioned, Paul, I do have a sneaky feeling now as the game creeps on and you get that glimmer of hope, and some might call it false hope. But I posed this question to Tony ahead of the match in Tala, and perhaps it's an almost impossible one to answer or put your finger on it, but what is it about Stephen Kenny and European competition for League of Ireland clubs?
I don't really know, Shane, yeah, but there's something about his style of play that really suits European opposition. And you know, European games are a little more like, okay, you have it, you probe, see what you can create, and then it comes over to you and you have a little spell of the ball. And it seems to suit his style of play. I think what his sides have always been really good at is transitions. He always plays with wide men, particularly with his League of Ireland sides, who have pace and who can hurt you. If you think back to the likes of Darragh Horgan, he goes with a similar type of player with El Bazzetti and a Mulroney. So it's all about transitions and counter-attackings, and they're very, very effective when they do that. But then they've also got technicians with the likes of Forrester, a Lennon, who can control the tempo of a game, and that kind of lends itself to his Dundalk team. Maybe not the same standard as a Stephen O'Donnell, but looking for that same style of player. And it just seems the blend that he has between those technicians and pace out wide seems to work really well when they play European oppositions. I think what Stephen does better than any other manager is giving sides belief. I mean, anybody you speak to within those camps, whether it's playing staff or non-playing staff, they don't feel as if they're a level below the opposition. They feel like they're equipped to go out, take down big names, take down big results, and progress through rounds. And you can certainly see that in the way they're playing here tonight. And the longer this game goes on, you can see the nerves seeping into that Turkish team. And you can see Pats, yes, they're getting a little more tired, but there's confidence in their play. And like I mentioned a couple of moments ago, I think whoever gets the first goal will go through in this. And the way the game is playing out, that could genuinely go either way.
62 minutes played in Istanbul. It is Istanbul, Başakşehir 0, St. Patrick's Athletic 0. We're taking a short break. We're going to chat more football with Paul, look ahead to Rovers tomorrow, hear from Stephen Bradley, chat Irish transfers, and then we've still lots to come. Michael Corcoran and Stephen Higgins will be chatting rugby and tennis. Stick with us here on Game On 2FM.
Game On
Football.
Well, it was all going so well for St. Pat's before we took a 90-second ad break, and we've come back from the ad break, and it is now Istanbul 1, St. Pat's 0, Paul Curry.
Yeah, I'm just waiting to see it back on a replay here, Shane, but they went down the right-hand side, and it's almost like an unfortunate deflection has found its way into the path of the left-back Sahinner, and to be fair to him, he's tucked it away really well past Joseph Anang. But Pat's sitting a little deep. They actually could have been given a penalty for a handball on Breslin, but it's ricocheted off Breslin. It's then dropped to Sahinir, probably about 9 yards out. He brings it past Gravoski with a little dummy and then slots it well, really well, past Anang. So that's disappointing, because we were just talking there about how well they're going. They're going to have to dust themselves off. This tie is far from over, Shane. There's a couple of players that Stephen can deploy from the bench that can certainly help, you know, get them back into the game. But it's not to get too disheartened, but it's now how can you find a way back into the game with 25 minutes to go.
Well, an uphill battle for Pats now in Istanbul. 65 minutes on the clock, 25 minutes ago, as you mentioned, Paul. A massive uphill battle for Shamrock Rovers against Pauok tomorrow. And we can hear from their manager, Stephen Bradley, now speaking to Tony O'Donoghue.
First leg, first half, we were very, very good. We get the man sent off, and it becomes extremely difficult against that level of opposition. And they expose us like you would expect them to do. Tomorrow it's about, can we go and win the game? I think winning the tie is near on impossible, but we can try and win the game, and that'll be the aim tomorrow night.
In terms of who's available in that, I mean, Johnny Kenny has been out for quite a bit. Is he likely to be recovered?
Johnny's back training today. I don't think we'll risk him tomorrow, but he is back training. Aaron Green picked up a knock on Sunday, he'll be out. Darren Nugent picked up a knock last Thursday over there, he'll be out. So we have a few out, but the squad's in a good place in terms of injuries.
Danny Mandrow's come back and already on the score sheet for you. Will he be a part of your plans?
Yeah, most definitely. I think we're trying to get Danny up to speed. I think we've seen on Sunday what he brings to us, and it's just trying to get them minutes built up for Danny now that he can start games.
You look at the Conference League to come, and you've got the group stage, or the league stage, as they're going to call it now. How is that going to affect your thinking for the league? Drop points again at the on Monday, so it's looking harder, as much as I know you don't want to give up your title.
I don't know, it's obviously hard. You're playing tough games Thursday and then Sunday, but this is where we want to be. It's not about looking for excuses, it's about finding a solution to what we want to do and what we want to achieve, and there's still a long way to go in the league. On Sunday I thought the performance, the large parts were really good, we just couldn't find that end product, and that sometimes happens, but we just need to stay focused, keep looking at the challenge in front of us, and let's see where it takes us.
And you look at the league and all the contenders, obviously Derry took over top spot for the moment at least, but no one is kind of grabbing this league and running away with it.
No, I think it's been very competitive this year. I think, like you said, from Derry right down to maybe 6th, 7th position, it's really tight. And I'd imagine that's going to be the case right up until the end of the season. It looks like no one's going to run away, as you said. And I think it'll go right down to the last game.
Paul, just because Stephen Bradley himself just mentioned the title run in there, before we do chat about Rovers against Pauk, a report in the Derry Journal today, Derry City's title ambitions have suffered a major blow after it was revealed Cameron Dumigan will miss the remainder of the season with a hamstring injury. The midfielder, who was also filled in at right back for the Candy Stripes in recent weeks, limped out of last week's crucial 1-0 victory over Waterford in the ORC on the 65th minute, and scans this week confirming the Lurgan native will miss the last 8 games of the title run-in. How much of a blow for Derry is that?
Yeah, it's a huge blow, Shane, and unfortunately for Cameron Dumigan, it's something that has not plagued his career, but has probably been a huge part of his career, is picking up injuries and missing big chunks of seasons. He only played 16 games for Derry last year and 15 games this season, and he's the type of player that whenever you see him, he probably goes under the radar a bit, and the good work that he does, whether he's playing fullback or playing in the middle of the pitch, keeps things ticking over, very comfortable with the ball and can be deployed in a number of different positions. And he is the type of player that, somewhat like a Gary O'Neill at Shamrock Rovers, you probably don't appreciate them until you take them out of the team and you realise the gap that they actually leave behind them. So he's somebody who Derry will miss, particularly in the run-in. And it's something that Rory's had to juggle quite a bit with when you think of the players that he's brought in, whether it be Duffy, McElhenney, Colin Whelan, Dumigan. They've picked up a lot of injuries, Shane, and Dumigan is certainly one of those key players that you don't want to lose, but they have done. And it's just whether or not the likes of a Diallo can come in now and plug that hole. But massive, massive void for Derry.
Derry play Galway on Friday. Shells are away to Dundalk, the Derry-Galway match in Terryland. And then there are matches over the weekend as well. Saturday, Sligo-Waterford. An early Sunday morning, Dublin Derby, Bowes Rovers and Pat's Drogheda as well, then on Sunday evening. But on Pat's in Europe, Paul, Aaron Green, Darren Nugent both missing out. Josh Honahan is suspended. Stephen Bradley was mentioned about Danny Mandreou just kind of getting match sharpness more so than match fitness. He did confirm Jack Byrne will start as well. The games are going to come thick and fast, even into the postseason as well for Rovers. So it is kind of about managing all of that. Like, how will they go into tomorrow, considering they are down by a sizable gap on aggregate?
I would expect that he'll probably rest a couple of bodies.
Yeah.
Maybe not 5 or 6, but certainly maybe 2 or 3 of the key players who've got a huge number of minutes in their legs, and maybe look to focus on deploying those players for the group stages. Shamrock Rovers is a funny one, Shane. Can't really get my head around some of their league performances. You only have to look at how inconsistent they've been with results and also performances in the league to know that it hasn't been one of their better seasons so far to date. But then you flip it into Europe and they've been really good. And tomorrow is about, you know, improving coefficients. There's prize money on the line for results in Europe. It's about maximising that opportunity and then trying to get the minutes into the players like Danny Mandreou, who I can't believe Danny Mandreou is actually back in the League of Ireland. I think he
should. Why is that?
Because I think he did well enough at Lincoln. I believe he had offers to stay in the UK, and I think he could have really pushed himself on to a next level coming back.
Is it regressive for his career?
I'm not sure if it's regressive, because if he
or is it just a bit of a reset?
I don't know. Like, it was a 5-month contract he signed, and maybe he's looking, if he can have a good European campaign, he can find himself with better offers on the table. But I just think he had done enough in the UK to stay in the UK and kick himself on to the next level. Technically, he's got really good aspects of his game. Physically, he's good. He's quick and get around the park. And like he showed against Galway, he's got a goal to his name. So it's a massive coup for Shamrock Rovers. And, you know, the likes of Danny Manju and Jack Byrne, it's important that you get minutes into those types of players tomorrow, because you're probably going to need them at certain points in the European campaign where you need somebody to put their foot in the ball, create chances, score the goals. They're the type of players who maybe been on the outskirts of things due to injury a lot of the time, for some of those players to give them minutes and try see what they can do in the game tomorrow. But the tie itself is dead and buried, Shane. Mm. You know, there's absolutely no chance you're going to come back against opposition like Pauk to a 4-goal deficit. But Stephen Bradley will be seeing what players can do in this environment and see maybe what shapes, what setups, what personnel he can use when he gets to that group stage.
Okay, 72 minutes played in Istanbul. You're going to keep an eye on the end of that one for us, Paul.
Aidan Keane's come on, Mason Melia come off, so first change and maybe the first roll of the dice from Stephen Kenny.
Okay, Istanbul did have a half chance there, a shot whizzing past Joseph Anyang's right post, but still 1-0, 72 minutes on the clock. We'll keep you up to date with that. We're going to turn our attention to rugby now, because RTE Sports' Michael Corcoran joins us on the line to go through the latest rugby stories. And Michael, we might begin our conversation with the news that Felix Jones has departed the England management setup. How big of a blow is this news to England, Michael?
Shane, yeah, it's a huge blow, actually. The timing of it is not ideal, and they're also in a situation where he's only been in the job a couple of months. He's built up a huge reputation for himself as a really good defensive coach, working obviously with South Africa, you know, when they won the Rugby World Cup, and has been there for quite a long period of time. Comes with a really, really good reputation. And he was the one that they had built their defence around in terms of planning towards the next Rugby World Cup. He was with England when they were in New Zealand, and did well out there with pretty good success. Working with Alad Walters, who was involved with Munster previously, and indeed South Africa. And Alad Walters has left a role within Steve Borthwick's setup as well to take on a gig as head of strength and conditioning,
I think it's in layman's terms anyway.
It's athletic performance, I think maybe is the phrase I was looking for, to take on that role. And the two lads are quite close in terms of being good pals and the whole thing or whatever. So it's a huge blow. The timing of it is not ideal from an England point of view, because the players are just getting used to his system and the new system bedding in. It does take a bit of time, as we've seen with Jacques Nienaber and Leinster. So it does take a bit of time. It's not just like changing your car where you trade in the old one and bring in the new one. The players had, players don't like disruption. They like continuity. And, the fact that the head of athletic performance is gone, there's one of the strength and conditioning fellas gone there as well. And now Felix Jones has handed in his notice. That's not ideal. It's a big blow for England, definitely, without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, it would seem from a lot of reports in the English media that it most certainly caught the players by surprise.
Completely unexpected. Yeah, I mean, that's the point about it.
It's a damning for Steve Borthwick's management style. If the quote that the Sunday Times are reporting was unhappy with an unstable working environment, and now, like, because he is so highly regarded, when you look at where to next, because we'd all like him back in Ireland, I'd imagine, but you'd imagine that the coaching rosters are full at the moment.
I would have said that they were, but the thing about it as well is that there are some quotes attributed to the Rugby Football Union from when the notice was handed in, that he'd have to serve out his notice period, which my understanding is that it could be up to 12 months. Now, normally, in kind of reading between the lines speak, over the years, that means that they're looking for money, which may very well be the case there. So that may be prohibitive in terms of the next move, because I think when the news was breaking that Felix Jones was leaving the role, everybody was scrolling through their Twitter feed and refreshing their emails to see, you know, somebody announces the arrival of Felix Jones. Congratulations, we're delighted to be associated with, and here he is, and it's I always wanted to go to X, Y, or Z, basically. So that step is blocked at the moment until something is sorted out. I mean, it would be fantastic if he was involved with back here in the Irish setup. Certainly, you know, the coaching rosters are kind of pretty full at the moment. There is possibly, you know, the possibility of a bit of room, if you understand what I mean, with Andy Farrell moving upstairs to take on the role with the British and Irish Lions, you know, for the tour to Australia next year. So there might be some bit of kind of wriggle room there in relation to that. There is also the possibility that Felix Jones could be the defence coach for the British and Irish Lions for that trip as well too. So, you know, there are possibilities there. I saw, you know, the Rugby Championship is on this weekend again. South Africa are playing New Zealand in Johannesburg, and the South Africa attack coach now is Tony Brown, the former New Zealander. And in New Zealand, they've lost their attack coach in the last couple of weeks or so. So, you know, the question has been raised within South Africa now whether Tony Brown would pack in the South Africa role to go and take on a role with New Zealand. So that may open up a possibility of a role within the South Africa setup, because Razi Rasmus, I know, is a really big fan of Felix Jones, and would give him a chance to link up with his old pal Gerry Flannery, who's there as well as the forwards coach. So, I mean, there are certainly possibilities. Could be a chance, maybe, that the knock-on effect of leaving England is that Sean Edwards could very well leave the France role, and then that might open up a vacancy in France. Do you know what I mean? So there's a bit of a... It's a bit like, what, today's Wednesday, two more days to go in the transfer window, and then because Wolves are looking to sign a goalkeeper today, Bournemouth signed a goalkeeper yesterday, so Mark Travers may end up getting a move. You know, that type of thing. So there's a bit of a kind of domino effect there, and that could very well be the case. There are possibilities there. It does look, from the outside looking in, as if the Irish system at the national level and indeed at provincial level looks as if it's full. But I would think if there was, I know David Humphreys quite well, and I mean, David Humphreys is a fellow who likes to kind of think outside the box. So there might be an opportunity for Felix Jones to be incorporated somewhere into the Irish system. I mean, a young man whose career was cruelly cut short because of injury, but he's very, very highly rated as a coach, and I'd love to see him back within the Irish setup.
Okay. Listen, Michael, just before we do let you go, David Nusafora has been confirmed with a new advisory role for the Scottish Rugby Union. Am I right in saying that it's more so looking over development structures?
I think he's been brought in to get the structure of Scotland Rugby right, because there's no doubt whatsoever. I mean, you know, built, say, on the success of Glasgow and the URC last year, they need to get their... I'll use the phrase, but I don't mean it in a bad sense. They need to get their act together in terms of getting the organisation of it right. There's no doubt whatsoever. I mean, they've only got two teams, so it's kind of, I would have thought, a pretty straightforward enough gig from that point of view. But I think they need to get everybody... it's a bit like the Donovan brothers and Fintan McCarthy all rowing in the one direction. And that's what they need to do in Scotland over the next couple of years. They're looking to appoint a high-performance director on a full-time basis. So part of David Nusafora's brief when he joins in November will be to advise them on that as well, but to try and get a better flow, I think, through the system to make Scotland more competitive at the top table there. And he has built up that reputation here within Ireland over the last number of years. Probably slightly surprising that he's jettisoned his beloved Australia so quickly, because he was expected to stay on there for a period of time. But I suppose the lure of living in Edinburgh proved to be too strong.
On that note, Michael Corcoran, thank you very much for joining us. Great stuff as always. We're taking a short break. It is still Istanbul 1, Pats 0. Stephen Higgins is with us to chat tennis. Paul Corry is still with us to keep us up to date with everything that is going on in Turkey.
Game on 2FM.
Now, it was Istanbul 0, St. Pats 0. We took a first ad break and then Pats were trailing 1-0. They were trailing 1-0 before we take our second ad break. And Paul Corry, It is now
the 2-0. The wheels have fallen off, Shane.
It's 2-0 and Pats have 10 men. What's been going on in the last... duration of our last ad break was, I think, 116 seconds or something like that. What has been happening?
Well, it was the 80th minute when St. Pat's won a corner that... Bezakasir have gone on a break, and Joe Redmond actually goes to take Kemen, the midfielder, down, misses him, and then Aaron Bulger comes out of nowhere with a kung fu kick, is the only way of describing it, from behind. Like, in that situation, Shane, I understand what he's trying to do, and he's trying to prevent a counter attack. Just drag him down or be a little more subtle. I mean, he's come off the ground with his 2 feet from behind and come right down the calf,
and you're on the pitch 3 minutes.
Exactly. And even, you know, if Pats were to remain in the game and equalise, they're still down to 10 men and have to play those 30 minutes with a man less. But it was only 60 seconds later that the same man who Bulger tried to take out with that tackle got on the end of a really well worth goal, Shane. They went down the left hand side with Lima, beautiful ball into the box, and Kemen got above the St. Pat's defender to head it in, and that is 2-0 and game, set and match. And it's disappointing because Pats were in that game, Shane, for 60 minutes. They just couldn't carve open a really clear-cut opportunity to score or put enough threat on the Turkish goalkeeper. But, you know, it was fine margins, and it was instances, and it was moments where Ricochet had the ball for the first goal, puts in Sahiner's path to put past Anand, and then obviously a moment of madness from Bulger has probably changed his tie.
Game, set, match. You mentioned Paul Curry.
Game on.
Tennis.
Stephen Higgins is with us to chat tennis.
Smooth.
I was hoping you were going to stop talking after you said that, Paul. Then you had another like exercise. Ah, oh, Paul, come on. Well, Stephen Higgins of Cross Court View, how are you? The US Open is continuing to entertain. What's been catching your eye today?
Well, we've already lost a reigning major champion in that Barbora Krejcikova, the Wimbledon champion, went out earlier in the second round to Elena Gabriela Rus, who's ranked 122 in the world. So not a great day for the Czech. Now, the Czech has been a streaky performer. She's primarily been a doubles specialist, world number one in doubles, and she did win Roland Garros back in 2021. But her form has deviated into various peaks and troughs since. So it's not a massive shock. She lost in the quarterfinals of the Olympics and hasn't played since in the warm-ups in America. Speaking of not playing in the warm-ups in America, unfortunately, Emma Raducanu went out last night to Sofia Kenin. And there was Emma Raducanu ploughs her own furrow, I suppose you'd say, of makes her own decisions in her path. And this has got criticism since she won her major. But one of the decisions she made was to skip Cincinnati and the Canadian Open, which is unusual for a player of that level. And the experiment didn't seem to work anyway, because
why would you skip events like that?
She had said that she wanted to practice herself and do her own thing. Possibly the suggestion, because her ranking is low, she'd have to play qualifying for the events. She wouldn't be given a wild card.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know if she thinks she's above playing qualifying for those events. I don't want to make suggestions, but it didn't really work anyway. She had played quite well in the grass court events, and the pause certainly didn't work for her. And yeah, there's still, you're wondering about Emma Raducanu, of what her career is actually going to be like. Will she be a one slam wonder, or is she going to be able to go back to an elite level?
You would imagine if she's going to go back to the elite level, might need to listen more to coaching and external.
Well, she's been through a few of the coaches, so I'm not sure.
Well, maybe not listen, but just stick with a bit more trust in one coach, per se.
It's very difficult with sports people, I find, that once you come down from that level, to go back to that level very rarely happens.
The thing is, well, she didn't have a foundation in her game of performing at that level before, and she didn't go through a traditional route of kind of being, you know, 200, 150, 80, playing in tournaments that got progressively more intense. She just exploded, having been injury prone, exploded at the US Open during COVID, and that really unusual time. So it's very hard to judge exactly what her level is. I think over the years since, it kind of seems like at times she can have world-class strokes, but it's not consistent. Like, sometimes she looks very good at certain things, but I wonder at times, compared to other players at elite level, even if you see a Świątek or a Sabalenka or Rybakina on a bad day, the forehand's still world-class, the backhand's still world-class to serve. You know, Coco Gauff's been struggling of late. Her backhand is still world-class in those performances. It's other parts of her game maybe that are fragile. With Raducanu, I think sometimes it looks very good or it doesn't look good at all, or she looks like she's struggling to figure out what she's trying to do.
Okay. Sometimes. Okay. You mentioned Coco Gauff. She cruised through her opening match in straight sets, as did Arina Sabalenka. And Naomi Osaka looked pretty good against Ostapenko as well, Stephen.
Yeah, it was great to see Naomi Osaka. She's quite emotional after the victory. Of course, she's a two-time champion there. She took her break, had a child. It's an amazing turnaround, because only a few weeks ago or a month or so she was talking about how difficult it was to get back to her previous level. I think she had a quote saying like it felt like she's not inside her own body when she's playing, and it was upsetting her. But she certainly was back inside her old body against Ostapenko, who's a very tricky customer, obviously a former major champion, hits very big shots but not always the most consistent. But Osaka looked good, and it was great to see her back at that kind of level, and you know, in a place where she's won twice before, maybe this will be the making of her second career, so to speak, of just her surging back to level that we'd all like to see, because she's such an exciting player to watch.
Before we get onto the men's side of the competition as well, just in terms of seeds already gone, Danielle Collins, Caroline Garcia as well.
Yeah, it's Collins was a bit of a surprise in terms of just she's retiring this year, even though she's had a really good season and she went out. Caroline Garcia has been struggling a bit for form. I was just checking at the scores there, and actually Qinwen Zhen, who was the Australian Open finalist and a medalist at the Olympics, is on the verge of going out to Erika Andreeva, which would be a bit of a shock. It's always the case with these Grand Slams. I mean, I write so many previews on the WTA side of Grand Slams, and I think this is going to happen, that's going to happen. And then because it's best of three sets, once a player gets a good first set under their belt and they get confidence, and if a top player is off, you get these surprises all the time. That said, in the women's draw, while I think the likes of Iga Swiatek is a little bit vulnerable after playing Cincinnati and losing straight sets to Sabalenka and having a tricky draw, Sabalenka's draw is brilliant. Sabalenka looks kind of just absolutely made for this US Open this time around. She decided to skip the Olympics, so she has that kind of break. She doesn't have the baggage or the hangover from Paris. So I think in a women's draw, while you never know what's going to happen, and there's questions over the likes of, say, Coco Gauff, who's really struggled in the hard courts coming into the US, Elena Rybakina, who split with her long-term coach just on the cusp of the tournament, and Jasmine Paolini, who didn't have a great American hardcourt swing. This is Paolini, the finalist at Roland Garros and Wimbledon. Sabalenka looks really good and was a convincing winner over Swiatek coming into the tournament. And she has a great draw. And I'd be very surprised if she didn't make the last four final. And I think she'll win it.
Okay, okay. On the men's side of the draw, before we reflect on highlights so far, Djokovic is in action or will be in action?
Yeah, so Djokovic is going to be in action later tonight. He's going to play actually his compatriot Laszlo Zverev. This is just looking like what a turnaround of a season for Novak Djokovic. He struggled through the season, didn't play at anywhere near his level, had to have knee surgery just before Wimbledon. Of course, had that miraculous comeback in a few weeks to make it to Wimbledon, got to the Wimbledon final. For his level, was kind of embarrassed by Carlos Alcaraz, actually, given his stature in the game, that it was so convincing a victory for Alcaraz, it would probably be a bit concerning for him in terms of his long-term prospects or his, you know, his near-term prospects. And then he turns around a few weeks in Paris and plays absolutely one of the best performances he's ever played in under the most pressure. And now he's been given this brilliant draw at the US Open. He's the four-time champion, the defending champion. And, you know, he had a very comfortable first round. He looks really good. It's hard to see anyone. The only one in the third round, he might play Alexis Papayrin, who won the Canadian Open coming in. But even so, these guys like Ben Shelton, Rublev, Dimitrov, you know, Zverev in the semis possibly. But they're just not guys that you think will beat Djokovic if he's even 70, 80% of a level. And because he's, of course, on the other side of the draw from Jannik Sinner and Carlos Alcaraz, you just see him getting to the final, like, you know, just the way he played at the Olympics, the way he's managing his body, that he looks sharp again. He really wants that 25th major to set himself on his own in tennis history. He has pretty much every record you can imagine, but he'd love the 25th to separate him from Margaret Court and put himself on his own.
Okay, you mentioned the other side of the draw. So what's kind of how is that playing out?
Yeah, so we have like Jannik Sinner, the world number one. Of course, he's been in the headlines lately where he tested positive for a banned substance, but then was cleared of negligence. And so he's been cleared. He's playing. He won Cincinnati beforehand coming in. there's a question with Sinner just because he's such a low-key kind of a guy. He did go and do his press conference before the tournament and he, you know, faced the questions and said, you know, like, I know I'm completely innocent. I didn't do anything wrong. But if this has been, you know, a shadow over me for months. It's just New York is so loud and it's such a kind of, you know, brash atmosphere. And now there's such a spotlight on him, not because of his tennis, but because of the story. Can he respond to that? So he did drop the first set in the opening round, but was convincing then against Mackenzie McDonald, winning the next three.
Are fans on his back?
It didn't seem so. He got a decent enough reception from it. Like, you know, I think Sinner is a good guy. And when you delved into the actual report about it, it seemed fairly plausible, like, what happened. He though has a very tough draw. Like, you know, if you look, project ahead of one Tommy Paul in his section is a really good player, is very tricky. But if you looked ahead to, like, if everyone met their seedings, he would have to go through three US Open winners back to back in Daniil Medvedev, Carlos Alcaraz and Novak Djokovic. That's a tall ask for anyone, even for the world number one. I still don't think at this point with the men's, you're kind of going with the expected ones of Djokovic and Zverev in one semi-final and Alcaraz and Sinner in the top half one.
Okay, great stuff. We're going to leave our tennis chat there for now. Stephen Higgins, thank you as always. Your gentleman, Paul, I was going to ask you a tennis question because I know you have a keen interest, but unfortunately we've ran out of road. Before we do finish up, there is what, we're in the 94th minute of 5 minutes added on in Istanbul. Pass nearly scored though, Paul.
Yeah, Brandon Kavanagh very, very nearly pulled one back, but it was a fantastic save. That was with 60 seconds left to go. So the game is just about to wrap up and decent performance from Pats, but a disappointing result.
Disappointing result. Well, hopefully Shamrock Rovers can put it up to Pauk tomorrow. We didn't even get to mention Chidozie Ogbene's confirmed move to Ipswich Town. Heimer Halgrimsson announces his squad tomorrow, so we will be keeping you up to date with all the latest transfers tomorrow and chat more on football tomorrow. Lots to come. Big thanks to John Farrell and commiserations to John Farrell as well, our St. Pat's producer. As it does look like it is going to finish 2-0. 30 seconds now left in Istanbul. Big thanks to Laurie Davis. Big thanks to you for tuning in to this evening's show. Dermot O'Brien is up next with the new music show, so do not go anywhere. Stay tuned to 2FM. We will be back 6 o'clock tomorrow. I shall speak to you then. RTE 2FM.